Welcome to the Realistic Healthy Living Podcast, where I share with you information that may help and support you as you work towards your own goals. This podcast can help you find a more realistic and practical approach to tackling common dietary challenges. I will be sharing some intimate interviews as well as my own insights to shed light on important nutritional and well-being topics. I'm Shani, your host and a certified nutrition consultant. I work with people seeking to look and feel better, providing them with realistic, safe, and doable solutions so they can reach their nutritional goals without giving up their favorite foods. Ready? So let's begin. Today I'm chatting with Sarah. Sarah and I initially intended to chat about diabetes, yet this episode quickly turned into talking about something else. An intricate pathway which led Sarah to where she is today has impacted her health, and she openly and beautifully talks about it. This episode is yet another reminder that there may be some events in our lives that could most likely turn into an underlying trigger and translate into health challenges later on in life. Sarah, now in her late 50s, expresses quite a few invaluable points that will remind us all of the interesting and complex collaboration between the body and mind. After our chat, I will share some of my thoughts about this subject, so please have a listen and I'll see you on the other side.
Hello, Sarah. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time and I'm excited to talk with you. So,
my pleasure.
Thank you. I'm wondering if we could start with you giving us kind of like a little bit of a background about when you were diagnosed with diabetes. What did it look like? What did it mean for you? Anything you're willing to share with us?
It was fairly gradual. It's funny, my whole life I always thought I would end up with diabetes. My mother had diabetes when she was my age. My uncle had diabetes. It seems to be all on my mom's side. And so it wasn't really a shock. I sort of was expecting them to say it. I was just had my children and I was always thin my whole life. Suddenly I was no longer thin. When my children were born, I was diagnosed with postpartum depression and post-PTSD from the loss of my first husband when I was 29 years old. And I guess I suddenly had everything he ever wanted, which was a baby. And he was an obstetrician who was killed in a plane crash when he was 28 years old. I was 29. I really never thought my life would go on. Then I got remarried and had children. And when I had my first daughter, it really messed with my head. And the meds they put me on really made me put on weight. And I was never huge, but I was a good size 20, I'd say. I was sort of half expecting it. And my sugars weren't that high, but they were high enough that they wanted me to start on metformin. It was almost like my PTSD meds were not allowing me to control my food intake. I wasn't morbidly obese, but I wasn't as skinny as I used to be. I was half expecting it. It was very strange. They put me on the metformin, and then I really didn't worry about it for many, many years. But as the years are coming on, I'm 57 now. I was 34 then. No, I was probably more like 40 when I was told I had the diabetes. It's creeping up, and now it's actually bothering me. Now I'm getting scared because both my mother and my uncle died from complications with diabetes. Now my diabetes is getting to a scary point.
Thank you for sharing that. I'm wondering if we could go back a little bit and if you could dive into that time of your life where you experienced such a massive loss and such a big change in your being. And how do you feel it had an effect on your behavior with food, if so?
Yeah, sure. It's interesting that you asked that, actually, because I had married my high school sweetheart, and we did love food. I'm a really decent cook, and he always used to say, why would we go out for hamburger when I can have filet mignon at home? It's true. I love to cook for him. He was an obstetrics resident. He preferred my food to going out, although we loved going out. You know, we were young and had very little money because he was just a resident, and I really became creative in cooking and I liked it. And I went from a very, very happy life, like extremely happy, to really thinking I would never I would possibly not live out the rest of my life. It was funny. I would not for about a year eat anything that he loved. So one that comes to mind is he loved chocolate macadamia nuts from Hawaii. And somebody brought them over to me when I was in my throes of my heavy grief and I burst into tears. And he loved this particular cupcake I make. And I think I didn't make it for years. When you do suffer grief, because I used to do grief groups after that, I ran grief groups for young widows, widowers. It's interesting. Your body, I think, attacks you. So your heart is hurting. I think you have nothing left to really give to your health of your body. So one of my dear friends at that point said, "You're coming to exercise with me." Well, I've never been an exercise person. I hate exercise. And I'll tell you, it helped me a lot. She would take me just to the gym and we would do a little bit of exercise and it did help me. But truthfully, the only thing that helped me was meeting my new husband because I felt like I was on a train track and I was not, it had derailed and I was never going to go on with my life, ever. I really thought my life was over. And when those things happen, I think when somebody's sad, you leave your body open to many, many illnesses. Tragedy, I think, doesn't allow us to heal ourselves unless we can make ourselves happy. No matter how hard you try, sometimes you just can't make yourself happy. And it took me a long time to realize that I needed some meds. I needed some help. It was a pediatrician that I went to who actually was a friend. I went to meet my late husband for a dinner when he was on call. He got called away to deliver a baby and I ended up sitting with her and I didn't know her. And I said, "What do you want in a husband?" And she told me everything she wanted in a husband. And I said, because she was a little bit older than me. And I said, "I think I have the perfect man for you." And she said, "Oh, Sarah, don't be silly." And I said, no, I really do. I think I have the perfect man for you. And I introduced her to my brother's best friend. And she called me after the date and said, "You've just introduced me to the man I'm going to marry." And they have been married for many, many, many years. And she was my pediatrician when I had Rachel, my first daughter. And it was her that said to me in the most loving way, she said, "Sarah," she said, you're not dealing with a new baby normally any longer. Thank God I had my mother who was helping me. I was not doing anything bad. I just wasn't coping. They tried everything to medicate me for postpartum depression and it didn't work. Finally, they, after much, much doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists, they decided it was PTSD, which makes complete sense to me. But I was very hard to medicate. And I think the medication that I know the medication they gave me has not helped my diabetes and my eating. And eating has always been what makes me happy. Eating and sex. That's my two favorite things. That's, I'm old. Now it's just the eating.
I love to hear that. You know, I'm listening to you and other than feeling so much of what you're saying and talking about grief and how it affects our emotions and our physical being. And it shows again that our body is a whole. It's not just physiology, but it's also our emotions and how they affect everything and how they go hand in hand. And when you are not happy or when you are suffering or struggling, there will be a translation of that into food. Some people may eat more, some people may eat less. In your case, that depth of grief, I feel that it is so complex and so deep. I don't know if we have enough knowledge yet to understand how grief affects our current life, our future life, our relationship with food or with pleasure or with anything.
That's right. I agree with you. And when you have one loss and then you get another loss, like losing parents, your grief compounds and it starts all over again. Then it starts a whole new thing of nutritional problems. And I do heal myself by cake.
Fair enough.
If I could have cake for most of my meals, I'd be very happy. So I used to, after I had my loss and somebody dragged me to the grief group at the Rocky View Hospital, actually my sister-in-law, my late husband's sister. And I said, "What am I going to do with a grief group run by a reverend at the hospital? I'm a Jewish girl. This is not what I would seek out." I went to synagogue. My late husband's family was so good to me. My own family was amazing to me. I moved from Vancouver, moved back home, never went back to Vancouver for years. She dragged me to this group, and it was amazing. It was helpful. It was amazing. Reverend Bob Glasgow was the one who started this group, and he started this group many, many years ago by thinking, geez, I think there's at the hospital thinking, I think there's a place that people should be able to talk about grief. And I think I'm going to do a 5-week. I'm going to start by doing one lecture. And he did one lecture. He was expecting, I think, 20 people. And I think he had 200 people show up. He passed away recently, and he was one of the most amazing people I've ever met in my life. After I came to him, he had many Jewish people come to his grief group. He himself had terrible rheumatoid arthritis. He was a very crippled man, never complained. He had many losses of his own that he talked about. And after I did the 5-week class, I said to him, if I could help one person as much as you've helped me, I would like to do this. About 6 months later, they asked me if I would consider coming to do grief groups with them. I was the first Jewish person to do grief groups with them. And I was the first person to do grief groups with them who was not a psychologist or a social worker or a reverend for that matter. I loved it, and they loved me, not to be full of myself, but I was probably the only one that could sit and make a joke. And it was allowed because I had been there. You commiserate with people who had been there. And so then my niche became dealing with young widows and widowers only. I ran many, many grief groups. And then I did many, many guest lectures. The Pharmaceutical Association asked me to speak. I've spoken at quite a few places. Each time it's very heartwarming. And as much as you can say, I love doing the grief group, the grief work. Every time I help somebody, I was helping myself a little bit too. So it wasn't 100% selfless. As my father said at my second wedding, he saw every time I helped somebody, I was helping myself a little bit. And it's true. When I joined the grief group, I thought, there's not going to be any other 28-year-old widows in there, so why should I come? Why should I come to sit with a bunch of 90-year-old people who've been with their spouses for 50 years? And I was one of the youngest ones in the group. And after I started doing the grief groups, we started running groups for just young widows and widowers. It was helpful. I haven't gone back to it for quite a few years. After you have a few losses, which is what I've had with my parents and my late husband's parents and my present husband's mom, they sort of tell you to stop for a little while because you're dealing with your own grief. And it's probably just now that I'm ready to start again. Lots of people come to the grief groups, and lots of people end up getting before that have had many, many struggles with their health. You start cooking for one. You become uncoupled. The person who tells you you look good every morning is no longer there, so why bother looking good anymore? There's lots of things that impact your health around grief. And grief, I think, has been the guiding part of my life since I've been 28 years old. No matter what, I will never be 100% happy like I was before. It's not allowed. I'm not allowing myself. Maybe 98, maybe 95. I will never get back that 100% happiness. It's just not humanly possible. It's a shadow in my life for the rest of my life. That shadow, I believe, has made me not 100% healthy. I was heading to a much healthier life before all of this. It was a very hard time. I've had not an easy time. When my mother passed away, who was my best friend, we didn't want my dad to be alone, so my whole family packed up and moved in with him to take care of him. And I renovated and I took care of him and I loved him and I loved my parents were the best parents in the whole world. And when he passed away, he left the house to me, and my siblings have never spoken to me since. Even though I paid for the house and paid for everything, I guess I was no longer useful to them because I had no more money to give them because they took it all. That's probably more information than you need, but that brought up all the grief all over again. And that's when I truly got, I think, quite sick. I ended up with malignant melanoma in my back. Thank God my daughter was in aesthetic school and said, I don't like that mark on your back. And she found it. And I said, oh, don't be silly. And she said, no, really, I don't like it. And I was going for a checkup and she circled it. And it was the size of a pencil tip, probably. The doctor said, what is on your back? I said, oh, my daughter circled it with an eyeliner. She wants you to look at it. She said, yeah, I think we should have to go look at that. Then I had the skin doctor remove it. And he said, I think it's nothing, but we're going to take it off. And then he called me back. He said, we have to have a conversation. And he said, this is the beginning of melanoma. We got to send you to the skin cancer center. So they did. And then they called me back and said, it's not the beginnings. You have malignant melanoma and you have to go to the Tom Baker. I think I had 40 stitches, 3 surgeries, and right down to the bone to get out this pinprick. After that, my blood sugars were great. They were doing okay. I was doing okay. And after that, my sugars went crazy and they have never come back down. Now, I just got a cortisone shot in my knee and they said it could affect your levels. And my blood sugars were 26.8 a few weeks ago. And if anybody knows about sugars, your sugars should be 7. I was scared. That would be if I didn't eat anything, they would even get to 26. So finally, my endocrinologist said, okay, you have to go to the hospital. And I went to the hospital and, oh, they're trying me on so many different drugs for this diabetes. At some point, I just want to reset. And Shani has helped me before. And I did really, really well when my blood sugars were really good when I listened to your stuff to tell me to do. I did really well, like little things, like start with a mouthful of peanut butter in the morning. Who would have thought that? And it did correct me. And I don't know why when I had my cancer, I sort of stopped doing everything. So I was just telling Shani, I think I have to reset. I think I need her again. to remind me what to do. Great tricks, like putting a date in a smoothie and maybe some cocoa powder. And it's funny, have that before my cake. And then she's right. I don't feel as much like having my cake. So I do remember stuff, Shani.
You're amazing. I'm so proud of you.
Now I just have to get my button gear to do it.
Thank you for saying that. But I'm thinking of the team of doctors that you are seeing. What is their message for you to manage all this health struggles you're going through?
They're very baffled by me because it's a bit of mental health, it's a bit of physical health, and it's, of course, diabetes, which sort of is the umbrella of everything, right? So everything becomes a food thing. As you know, I love food. Food is how I heal. Food is how I heal people. My greatest pleasure is to bring somebody a cake that they love that I make. That's one of my fondest things to do. I love it. And in giving to other people, I know it sounds corny, but it does make me feel a little bit better. And the health professionals are very confused. I mean, if I have to see another doctor, I'm going to pull my hair out. They just cannot figure out why meds aren't helping me. I'm very hard to medicate. I was hard to medicate with the PTSD. I was hard to medicate with postpartum. Now they're having a hard time medicating me for my knee, which I will eventually need a new one. And now, of course, the umbrella of it all is diabetes. And I'm on way too many pills. I've seen their dietitians. I guess I don't quite understand because it doesn't matter what I eat. It's not going down. And now I'm on so many meds. Now they put me on Trulicity, which I don't know if anybody knows about it, but it's a 1 week injection. And the 1 week injection, then I have insulin before I go to sleep. And I have 2 glycosides in the morning. And then I have 2 metformins at night. So that's a lot of meds. Today, I finally woke up with a blood sugar of 10, which was their goal because my blood sugars have been so high. But last night, we went out for supper and my blood sugars were 5. I went to a meeting and I came home and my blood sugars were 16. And truly, you act like a crazy person when your sugars go crazy. On top of that, and I believe some menopause, I'm not the person I used to be. My husband and my children said, why are you being crazy? And I really was. I was not. And you're not able to control it. Peter, my husband, kept saying, should I get you some orange juice? I said, no, my sugars are too high. And I'm not generally a mean person, but you can't control it when your sugars are going crazy. You actually can't control what you're saying, how you're saying it. And sadly, my family gets the brunt of it. I'm very hard to control. And I've seen the dietitians. And for me, because I've had such a sad beginning of my life, if they tell me to never eat another piece of bread or never eat another piece of cake, I'm not going to do that. Because to me, that's not living. And I'm not going to deny myself all these things forever, because what's the point?
I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I named this podcast Realistic Healthy Living. Mm-hmm. You know, there is the pinnacle of healthy living that is written in the books and we could all look at and say, oh, that sounds so ideal. But is it realistic? And realistic is different to every person. One person will never give up cakes because that's their their love and their go-to when they feel this way or the other. And another person, something realistic for them would be to go climb a mountain. Everyone has their own way of realistically living with healthy choices. And when you say to give up one of your favorite foods, which is cakes, I agree with you not willing to cooperate because, you know, life is challenging anyhow. So the little nuggets of peace, quiet, and happiness are kind of like helping us go and plow through those challenges. So why take them away?
Mm-hmm. I agree. We have so little that internally makes us 100% happy where we don't have to involve anybody else. And I think, like you said, some people climb a mountain. I'm not going to do that, but I will bake a cake.
There you go.
and I try to give lots of it away, but and now my husband's doing keto, so he won't touch it. So now if I bake a cake, I have to eat the whole thing.
But that's exactly it. You know, some people claim that they have a healthy lifestyle, but let's imagine a scenario when someone has, you were talking so beautifully about being 100% happy, and I can take the same analogy and throw it into living healthy. What is living healthy? And again, to one person, it may be this, and to another person, maybe another. But I think the question would be, as far as healthy choices, is your lifestyle and the healthy choices you make allow you to go and continue with that route long term? Or is it a choice that, yeah, I can do that for maybe a week or a month or 6 months, but I needed to have a deadline and then I won't be able to continue living like that. So
that's correct. Can't be a lifestyle change for me to eat that way.
Exactly. I believe, and this is kind of like my approach with my nutritional consultation, is that I think we don't need to stop eating what gives us pleasure. I think we just need to learn how to incorporate that into our life, or how to incorporate some other healthy choices that will allow us to enjoy the food that we like.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. Now with all the new diets, don't eat carbs, do eat carb. Don't have brown rice, don't have white rice, don't have any rice. It's not fun for me. I'm not going to have a salad every day for supper. I mean, I don't mind having, I will have a salad every day as part of supper, but I'm not going to have it as my supper.
But also, would the salad be enough for you? Would
No.
you feel full after having a salad? You know, at the end of the day, if you had a meal and mm-hmm. the meal was not satiating.
Yeah, it wasn't
you
filling.
Will go, exactly. You will go and find a way to feel fuller in other ways that maybe are not
absolutely
helping you.
I could actually not eat all day, but from 6 o'clock till midnight, I could eat everything in the house.
There you go. So that's another thing. So building on that, maybe we can dive in a little bit into what does a day look like for you as a person with diabetes, as far as food, activity, work, lifestyle, choices?
Well, now I'm an interior designer. That's what I'm trained as. And I'm working full time. I get up in the morning and I crave carbs. So the one thing I shouldn't really have is a whole bagel because that will spike my sugar. What I should be doing is getting up and making myself some scrambled eggs with cheese or something. And I just don't bother ever taking that time to do it. Sometimes I'll make oatmeal. I tried a special oatmeal that was wonderful that a doctor had suggested to me. It spiked my sugar outrageously. If I have some fruit, my sugars are going up. So I've been trying to make a yogurt, which I think you taught me, and a plain yogurt with some fruit and some granola on it. And sometimes if I'm really smart, I pack that and have it at work. I've now started to keep some nuts at my desk, which is good. Then it's funny, I will make lunch for anybody. I just don't bother making it for myself. So that is my biggest struggle, is that if I could just make my lunch and put it in the fridge and take it with me to work, and then I get so busy at work, and then I'm out seeing clients, and then, there's a McDonald's, maybe I'll just grab a cheeseburger, but I won't have the fries today. I'll just have the cheeseburger. And then I go back to work, and then by the time I come home, I'm making supper, or else my husband has started supper. supper's okay, but then, like I said, from 7 o'clock on, 6 o'clock on, I could eat everything in the house that's a snack that's bad for me. My sugars, I have an alarm on my phone that is tells me when my sugars are going up. And lately my sugars, like I said, have been going crazy. So that alarm goes off at work and everybody's like, Sarah, what are your sugars? I'm having a cup of tea with a sweetener in it and some milk right now. And I'm sure my sugars have gone up. Usually my tea is spiking me to 14 in the morning. And that's really bad. And then all you do is pee out sugar. And then it's a nasty little vicious circle. And then you get lovely yeast infections because you're peeing out so much sugar. And you just really feel gross. I just want to sleep when it gets that high. That's my day. I'm not taking care of myself very well with food. And when I was at home during COVID, you told me to make myself a smoothie partway through the day. And I was. It was really helpful. And I know you're right. And I know those things are helpful. Do I want a smoothie or do I want a piece of cake? Well, the piece of cake is faster.
You said something really interesting that I think I would like to know more about. You said that you are ready to provide lunch for everyone and bake for everyone. On the other hand, you know what you need to do in order to feel better, but something is stopping you. Are you able to know?
Yeah, laziness, I think. And I'm busy. If you saw my kitchen right now, you'd think I was a hoarder. I have to clean it, and I haven't cleaned it since last night. So today's my day off, and I know that I have to clean my kitchen. I'm sitting here staring at it thinking, yeah, I don't want to do that.
Because it's not fun. I'm just wondering, because I run into that with a lot of people that tell me, I know what I need to do, but I don't do it. Mm-hmm. So what's on that bridge?
I'm too busy. I'm way too busy. I'm taking care of my husband ripped his shoulder into 1,000 pieces. He has very little use of one of his arms, although he's doing lots now around the house. That's good. He's back at work. One daughter's at home and her boyfriend is here a lot. And so I'm always making sure they have what they want, but I'm not cooking for all of them anymore because I've hurt my knee so bad. So now I think it's, aside from laziness, I think I'm just not feeling great. So I work really hard in the day, come home, and then I have to put my knee up for a while. If I get supper on the table, I'm very proud of myself, and then I'm sort of done. But what I should be doing is be making enough supper that I can take it the next day for work. I'm not always doing that. I'm very bad. I need a personal chef. We all do. Maybe I'm just getting old and I need to stop working. That's maybe what I need to do. My other problem is we eat out much too much. It's one of my guilty pleasures. And because we're all so busy working, it's like, oh, do we want to cook or do we go out? When you go out, of course, you can't control the calories, the salt, the sugar.
So how often do you go out?
3-4 times a week, probably. A lot. We go out a lot. That's not always, but like we were out last night for supper and I know we're going out on Thursday for supper. Then we'll likely go to a movie or something on the weekend and I'll eat an entire bag of popcorn and a chocolate.
So what kind of, like when you go out for supper, what kind of places would you go to without necessarily saying the names of the restaurant?
Italian. My favorite is Chinese, which is the absolute worst thing for me. But we don't do that very often anymore because I'm the one who likes it the most and my husband's doing keto. So a lot of the time we're doing steak places, which is good. Last night was Italian and I know Thursday is Italian. I try to not have the pasta, but I will. Terrible for my sugars. If I go for lunch, I can generally just have their one particular restaurant I love that does best salad. And I tried to duplicate it the other day and I actually did a pretty good job. And it was romaine lettuce with spaghetti squash and asparagus, some red onion, carrots, and chicken breasts grilled on it. And then I added some sweet potatoes to it. And that, to me, was a delicious, healthy, satiating lunch.
It sounds amazing.
It was really yummy.
You touched on it a little bit, but I'm wondering if we could go into the combination of physical and emotional impact of having diabetes on your life.
Well, it's interesting. I never thought diabetes was any impact at all on my life at all. And then I took care of my mom as soon as I came back and her diabetes got to the point that she needed insulin. And I guess the emotional part is I see my mother and myself. And that's when she got really quite sick. So I get really very frightened by it, but not frightened enough to really take care of myself so much. the emotional impact is bad. I don't want my children to get diabetes. I'm really quite certain that one of them will. It's funny, my mother, there was always homemade soup on the stove. There was always homemade supper. There was always something. I woke up to a beautiful breakfast, and that's because she was a stay-at-home mom. And I think that's the way I should be as well. But I don't stay at home anymore. I go out. So the emotional part is, I guess I'm just afraid that I can't control it. Maybe I'm not willing to control it enough. I know I should be much, much better at than I am. And then I have this underlying sadness, and food makes me happy. With the loss of so many family members, then I think the one thing that I can control is my food. And I know some people control it by sadly eating disorders, where they want to control their food by not eating. And I go the other way. I know I sound like I'm probably 500 pounds and need to be cut out of my house, but I'm not. Actually, the scary part is, just recently, I lost 20 kilos, and nobody knows why. Nobody knows how. It was because of the Ozempic, which is a different drug I was on, just made me so unwell. So they started checking me for every type of cancer you could ever think of, because you shouldn't lose 20 kilos in 2 months. It's just too much.
It's a lot.
It's a lot. They just can't figure it out. That's how diabetes is affecting me that way. They're still testing me for a bunch of stuff, but thank God nobody can find anything else wrong with me. And it always comes down to, it's my diabetes. Always. But I should be way more under control. So they're looking. It's hard to know that they're always looking for something on me. Like, they just insist my sugars can't be this high. Who wants to be on this many drugs? I feel I'm doing something wrong. But then again, it goes back to my underlying unhappiness, or sadness, I should say, that I don't think is allowing my body to heal from within very well.
Have you gone to therapy throughout the years?
So much therapy. I've had so much therapy. My therapist, from when I lost Jeff, my first husband, at 29 years old, is still my therapist. She has become, I'd say, a dear friend, and I'm probably one of her oldest clients. She's been with me through everything. But then the diabetes nurse they sent me to said, yeah, we think we want you to go see, it's a special thing through the healthcare where you see a social worker, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, you see all of them at once. And they just want to talk and see what, if I'm being medicated properly, if everything's okay. And so I did that. I saw them, and the girl was very intrigued with my sad story. And then they all came back to me and said, we think you need to write a book. I said, yes, I probably will. Actually, I'm starting to write a book, I think. I'm going to call it Loss, Love, and Latkes, because it's going to be a cookbook along with stories of my loss.
Well, sign me in. I'm going to buy it.
Oh, that's very sweet. But it's just because so much of my mental health, my diabetes, is around food. You know, I was going to make them my cupcake recipe that my Jeff loved so much, and then a honey cake that everybody brought to me while I was grieving. And so I've had so much therapy. When they first diagnosed me, the same psychologist that I've talked to could not drug me. There was no drug that was working. They just couldn't get a drug in me. And then they did a blood test, and it seemed like I wasn't even taking the drug. They said it was like, it's not even in my body. That was the weirdest thing. So they finally, a psychiatrist put me on, he was the one who got me on a drug, which I still take to this day. And it's one of the oldest drugs. And it's the only reason I can get to sleep at night. And it's what I take just to calm down enough to go to sleep at night. But a lot of my stuff, including my diabetes and my eating, is mental health related.
The body and mind, they work together all the time. And I think, always, when we treat something, we have to take all aspects, the emotional, the mental, and the physical. We cannot separate those.
I agree. When I was younger, I was healthy. My happiness with my world made me a well person. I had the best parents in the world. Then I met my Jeff when I was 17 and never looked back. I mean, he was always going to be my person. And like I said, then when he died, my train was derailed. My whole life is a different path because of that incident. Completely different path than I think my life should have been. And I don't know what the purpose is for me to have had so much sadness in my young life. I truly always have been nice to people. I try not to hurt anybody. But there has to be some reason, whether I'm supposed to help somebody or whether this is hell and then we're going to all go to heaven. I just don't know. But there's got to be some reason. My nephew said when Jeff died, boy, they must have really needed a good doctor up in heaven. And it's true. We don't know. We just don't know. I just don't know why this is my path and other people have terrible paths. And I should not feel sorry for myself because I'm cancer-free and diabetes is just a little blip, hopefully. But it's all surrounding food, isn't it? Everything.
Food is definitely a part of it. But again, I think it's a combination of the psychological aspects that we go through our lives. And yes, nutrition, physiology, it all comes together. And as far as what you said about purpose, that's a whole different subject I could talk to you for hours about, which I have no clue. I don't know if someone can say they are 100% sure about the explanation of it and the purpose of it.
You look at people and you think they're 100% happy, 100% happy, but nobody's really 100% happy. I don't believe that. I was pretty close to 100% happy when I was younger. But there's always something. There's always somebody who's worse off than you, right? Than I am. And I have to try and remember that. But I do complain a lot.
Complaining, I think it's kind of like a let out, a channel for us to get rid a little bit of things that are on our heart and are too difficult to carry. So it's not complaining. It's kind of like... No.
My psychologist said once they're starting to do something where they can do almost like a picture of your heart and they can see with a massive loss like I've had that your heart is actually not damaged, but altered, completely altered. They're going to do more studies on it, I think, but where your heart actually gets a complete alteration from what it used to be. And they're wondering if that's from losses or from getting, you know, it sounds like it does alter your heart a little bit.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. Sarah, what would you expect your community or people around you to do or say or behave as to help you with your diabetes, if there's something?
I it's funny, I don't want somebody to say to me, you really shouldn't be eating that. I don't want them to say that. That would make me very mad. But supporting me like my husband does, when he said, you know, that you're not acting yourself, I think you need some juice, or what could I do for you? If my community is my family, so my husband, my daughter, if they ever wanted to cook me a meal and say, Mom, this is perfect for you, that would be very supportive. Being kind to me, helping me. I know my husband and daughters worry about me a lot. Peter would actually do anything to try and make me feel better, try and make me happy. Same with my daughters. You know, support me. Let me live my life. If they wanted to say, let's go for a walk, that would be nice. Let's just go out. Just being happy with my family is really and my friends. But not to banter me about what I should eat and what I shouldn't eat. That's not good. Suggestions are great. It's sort of my fault that I'm not doing better than I should be. I do want to find blame in something. I want to make it the fault of my cancer or the fault of my knee. I clearly don't want to take the blame on myself. But
what would you expect the community of health professionals to do to help you?
Well, they're doing what they can. Truthfully, the last few weeks, I would think they should actually put me in the hospital in the last month and do all the tests to find out what's going on with me, rather than me waiting a month for this test and a month for that test. And all those things cause great stress, and that makes my diabetes go crazy too. So if you would have asked me a few weeks ago when my blood sugars were 26.8, I would have said, just admit me to the hospital, fix me, tell me that I'm okay, and then send me on my way. Don't send me home at 26.8 and say, come back if you need us.
I think your message is so, so important, because what you're saying is that I've suffered enough. Can someone please tell me what to do, give me what I need, and just fix it? And I think that's a lot of frustration that I hear around me because of my profession, that there's a lot of questions that have no answers. And at the end of the day, it is the individual that suffers and has to deal with all that.
And then you just sit and ruminate, you sit and think, and it goes over and over and over again in your head. And would I have done that if I was feeling better? And I would love for there to be a diabetes health and wellness center where if you know that you're not controlled, like I'm not controlled right now on my diabetes, you can almost check yourself in ahead to go in for a week and have a whole wellness session where they test everything, my sugars, my heart, my exercise level, my food intake. And somebody could say, okay, that's not right. Let's do this instead. Like have someone like you, Shanee, that could be there and say, let's try this instead before you have that piece of cake. Like they used to call a fat farm where you go and you and they teach you, but they teach you about your diabetes because I just don't think what they're checking for. They want to know that I'm doing okay, but just know that parts of me are going to fail with my sugars this high. And it's a little bit scary. So I can't say any of my people aren't wonderful. They are wonderful. But they can only do what the healthcare system allows them to do.
Of course.
To whoever needs it.
What a nice thing to say.
Yeah.
So on this note, Sarah, thank you so, so much for sharing all this with us. I really appreciate your time and everything you said. And I wish you happiness and health.
Thank you. I wish the same for you.
When Sarah and I initially started this conversation, our mutual intention was to chat about her challenges with diabetes. As the episode proceeded, her struggle with trauma and grief became the center of our conversation, as well as their impact on her overall health. Before diving into a few pointers I would be sharing, I want to go over a few points to keep in mind about trauma. First, there are generally three types of trauma. Acute, which happens from a single incident. Chronic, which is repeated over an extended period of time. An example for that would be domestic violence or abuse. And the third one is complex trauma, in which the individual is exposed to different and multiple traumatic events. When we experience trauma, it can express itself initially as sadness, confusion, exhaustion, dissociation, as well as physiological arousal. We can experience one, few, or all of these symptoms. In some people, trauma can express itself in the ways I just mentioned rather quickly, or it can show in a delayed onset. In addition, some people may experience an improvement in their traumatic behavior, some people do not, and some can experience that their subsided pain is triggered all over again due to occasional external or internal factors, even though a long time had passed since the traumatic event. As this podcast is about realistic, healthy living, I would like to share my own thoughts about ways to potentially help in such cases, but I do realize that it is easier said than done. Before doing so, I would like to emphasize that I am not a qualified trauma professional, nor do I claim to have the proper education in that subject matter. I am a nutrition professional, and my input is only on the nutritional side while taking a more holistic approach. Keeping in mind that trauma is experienced subjectively and the needs of the person may change as time goes by, my following thoughts are general and may not apply to everyone. Although grieving is challenging enough, I feel it is my duty to present some options with the hopes that it could potentially help even one person. Whatever you decide to do, please consult with a doctor first, as this is a very serious health and wellness matter. First and foremost, I do believe that psychological or psychiatric therapy is a crucial part of dealing with grief and trauma. I think that there are many types of therapies which a person could choose from and have access to, but the bottom line is to seek professional help. Working with a professional can have a substantially positive effect on the way we deal with our trauma and can also positively impact our health. When that is not possible for any reason, finding a proper organization or a supportive community can also help.
Once professional help is on the way and a proper amount of time has passed from the traumatic event, which of course would be different for each person, providing the body with the proper nutrition would be an important complementing part of therapy. Now, this does not mean giving up foods that you turn to in times of deep sadness or grief, if that is your case, but it would be more of fueling the body with certain foods on a regular basis that will provide the body with what it needs to deal with the grief. I would want to encourage a person to ensure they are properly nourished most of the time, when possible, providing their body with all the building blocks of proper nutrition, including all the macronutrients, which are protein, fat, and carbohydrates, as well as checking that there are no deficiencies in certain vitamins and minerals. I do take into consideration that this suggestion is highly attached to the proximity to the trauma, as our appetite is highly affected by such an event. The reason to pay some attention to nourishing our grieving body is due to the fact that it most likely spends above and beyond effort in repair that is not a common daily repair. Providing the right fuel can help the body with the proper energy to better withstand the physical and emotional stress experienced. Wholesome foods, home-cooked meals, foods high in fiber content, plenty of fruits and vegetables, and an emphasis on protein, which has a major part in repair, are a great way to go. The third and last point I would like to bring up is a topic that has been studied, but unfortunately with no clear findings as of yet, and that is physical activity. Some studies have shown improvement, but it is still an area that is lacking conclusions. I still wanted to bring it up, as some people may absolutely benefit from it. Just like food, depending on the proximity to the traumatic event after proper rest and needed recovery, a certain physical activity can help with the ability to deal with trauma, most likely due to the release of endorphins. The type of activity to do would depend on a variety of factors, such as the person's previous physical activity levels, willingness to try, health status, and other factors. Some may benefit from a mild activity such as walking outside in the fresh air, while others may need an extreme sport to exert some energy into a completely other task to help their mind be off the emotional pain and struggle. My overall message is that it is important to keep in mind that there are many other factors that come into play when someone chooses to look into supporting steps. It is crucial to keep in mind that the grieving person is not alone and that there are some options out there for them to try that could even improve a little how they deal with their pain.
I hope this episode provided you with some value. If so, your support will really help me. Here are two simple ways to do so. The ideal and easiest way would be to click the follow sign. And if you're willing, please share my podcast with anyone you think could benefit from it. Thank you for joining me today, and I'll see you in the next episode.